From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Congrats to North Carolina defeating Gonzaga tonight, men's NCAA basketball champs. Happy birthday to Coast Insider, Todd Babin. Happy birthday. Have a great one, Todd. And later tonight, we'll talk about Magic. Here's what's happening. The mosquitoes that can carry the Zika virus have reportedly now appeared in 129 California cities. Wow. With cold weather, the only major obstacle to the Zika virus becoming America's first pandemic, they say, since 1957, since the Asian flu, ground zero for a potential pandemic is now the West Coast. We'll keep our eyes on that and see if they're just blowing it out of proportion. A Kansas man has pleaded guilty to killing his 7-year-old son, and then he fed his body to pigs. Michael Jones, 46 years old of Kansas City, pleaded guilty to one count of first-degree murder in the death of little Adrian Jones, whose remains were found in a barn at a property rented by Jones and his wife, according to the Kansas City Star. Craziness. The man, suspected of killing 11 people in a St. Petersburg Russian train in his early 20s, apparently, from Central Asia, at least 45 people injured in that explosion between two underground stations. News agencies out there say they believe he was a suicide bomber. North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un is reportedly growing desperate and is ready to strike the United States with a nuclear weapon, according to a defector from the regime. Tao Young-ho, the most senior North Korean defector in 20 years, says that Kim is desperate in maintaining his rule by relying on his development of nuke weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles. It's time to bring in Howard Bloom, of course, and get his reaction to all of this. Howard, I have a strange feeling about this stuff.
Well, George, it's one of the most frightening situations in your lifetime and mine. Here's the deal. Kim Jong-un, North Korea's seemingly crazy dictator, is rapidly building a nuclear arsenal. It's estimated that he now has 8 nukes, and that the next one he'll test will be 42 times more powerful than the last one. It's also clear that he's working toward intercontinental ballistic missiles designed to hit cities in the United States. Now, Kim Jong-un has said that the United States is his deepest enemy, and he refers to the South Korean government as a mere American front, a batch of, he calls them, warmongering U.S. puppets, puppet confrontation maniacs, quislings, traitors to the nation, hell-bent on war moves against the North until the last day. But here's the big question. Do we need to eradicate Kim Jong-un's weapons before they can threaten our cities? Now, in his presidential campaign, Donald Trump said that he would bomb enemies into the dust. Is that what's actually needed in North Korea? As Britain's The Guardian put it, does it take, quote, a maverick president to stop this maverick dictator? Now look, bombing North Korea's nukes into the dust is not that easy. Kim Jong-un's nuclear and missile facilities are tunneled deep inside of mountains, and they are hidden. Is it possible to eradicate them with anything less than nuclear weapons? So this is why this just may be the scariest scenario of your lifetime or mine. World wars are started by accidental domino effects, and attacking North Korea could topple the biggest domino in Asia, China. If we attack North Korea, we need to do it in cooperation with China. Otherwise, our attack could result in a counterattack from the Chinese, who have had nuclear warheads mounted on ballistic missiles for 50 years. Now, how do we make sure that such a counterattack does not occur? Step one, do exactly what Donald Trump is doing this week. Meet with China's head, Xi Jinping. But here is the real trick. In Donald Trump's negotiations with China's Xi, Trump can have an ace up his sleeve if only he knows about it. In July 2016, Kim Jong-un was unhappy about China's work with the U.S. to slow North Korea's development of nuclear weapons. The North Korean dictator called China, quote, a detested enemy in a letter to his population, and he called on the North Korean people to crush China with the force of a nuclear storm. Yeah, the madman of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, actually threatened China, his protector and his allies, with a nuclear storm. In other words, just 8 months ago, Kim Jong-un threatened China with the very same nukes he is aiming at America's troops in the Pacific and that he wants to aim at American cities, which means that North Korea's nukes could be just as dangerous to China as they are to the United States, not to mention to South Korea and Japan. So China, if Trump knows about this and plays this right, China might have a very good reason to join with us in a preemptive military strike to eradicate North Korea's missile and nuclear program, if only Donald Trump knows about it.
And this is going to happen fast, too, Howard, so keep your eyes on it. Howard Bloom, thank you so much. A 20-year-old student at a Connecticut university has died after choking during a pancake-eating contest on campus. Jeez. More than half of the U.S. jobs at the U.S. newspapers have disappeared since 2001, with a large portion of the losses offset by employment gains at internet firms as well. But the newspaper business is slowly going away. Online shoppers rejoice. UPS will finally deliver packages on Saturdays. They're opening that up, and they're going to create 6,000 new jobs by the end of 2018 to do all of that. Rare in brief bursts of cosmic radio waves have puzzled astronomers since they were first detected 10 years ago. Some suggested these mysterious bursts of energy could be a sign of alien life trying to contact us. Now scientists have confirmed that the mysterious signals really do come from outer space. From exactly who and why, they don't know yet. Let's check in, by the way, what else is going on in the skies? Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Hi, Stephen. What do you have for us?
Hi, George. So many exciting things happening here in April. But you mentioned about the fast radio bursts, and I want to mention to the audience, they were first detected by radio astronomers back in the year 2007, and the time period in which these bursts are incredibly short, milliseconds. And what astronomers really are scratching their head all over the world, nobody really understands the dynamics behind this. It could be neutron stars emitting large amounts of gamma ray radiation, or it could be galaxies or black holes in some sort of collision. But what's interesting is astronomers and radio astronomers actually ruled out the local microwave that was inside some of these observatories, because that has given many people false hopes of this radiation not necessarily coming from space. But closer to home, George, here's something really cool. Last Thursday, astronauts on the International Space Station, including Dr. Peggy Whitson and another fellow astronaut, were doing a spacewalk to seal off one of the areas that are open, so for docking, and they were trying to attach this micrometeoroid shield. Well, as news goes now, it got away from them. And here's the interesting part about this. It weighs 18 pounds, 3 inches thick, about 5 feet long. And folks, if you're out there and you're watching the International Space Station and you track it, let's say it's a drsky.com satellite locator, one of the many sources you can track the passage of ISS, George, you could actually take a pair of binoculars and maybe a minute before the ISS passes, observers are actually seeing the object as a small stellar object, this incredible shield, which will eventually will burn up. But from the live sky, here's some quick tips for observers in early April. We find Mercury to be easy to see for those of you with a clear sky to the west. It's at one of its great elongations that'll last all week, the innermost planet. And don't forget, Jupiter comes to opposition finally. We've been talking about it for weeks. Easy and unmistakable to see. That's the bright object that rises just after sunset in the east. And Georgia's most beautiful moon right now, first quarter, just passed. And then as we come to the 11th, the beautiful April full pink moon. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. As you know, a couple times a month we feature podcasters from all over the planet, people who are doing great work and need a little more exposure. Well, here's one who doesn't need a lot of exposure, but it's called The Power Hour.
I don't know where to begin on this subject, but I do want to make sure that everybody listening understands the importance of what has taken place by the admission that the VA has withheld health studies on soldiers' toxic exposures. Now, that's why it kind of sounds like it mitigates the problem, minimizes the problem. It doesn't. This is huge. Not only does it mean that they withheld studies, they didn't just withhold studies, they allowed people to die for no reason. They withheld information that could have saved the lives of these troops. We're talking about murder, manslaughter. And as I have told you for many years, the stories of my being involved in whistleblowing situations, there are a lot of people that have tried to say, oh, that wasn't true, it didn't happen, she didn't do that.
And that's the voice, of course, of Nurse Joyce Riley. You've heard Joyce on our program many times, but she's the one who hosts the Power Hour. Joyce, good to talk to you again.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure, George, and an honor. Thank you.
What a great show. You've been doing this for how long now?
Well, about 12 years now. We've been at it, exposing what we believe to be truths. And, you know, we go, people like us, we seem to sort of join together in this kind of cohesion of thoughts of people that don't like the fact they've been lied to all these years. And so now as we start to uncover one thing at a time, we realize so much outside of our home has been a lie. So it gives me the opportunity to express how I feel, and I am just honored to be able to sit in the seat and talk to people like we're able to do. But, George, to meet people like yourself and to talk to others out there who are really doing things, because we have been lied to, and I'm just loving it as I see the scales fall off of people's eyes.
We've been doing this now, Joyce, for years, even when I was doing my local St. Louis show, and here we are now. You're still in Missouri these days, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
And for people that want to hear the Power Hour, it's a three-hour show. It's Monday through Friday, 7 to 10 o'clock Central Time. How do they find you?
Just go to thepowerhour.com or GCNlive.com, and we're there, and you can listen to archives also. And boy, you've just been doing such an incredible job spearheading this on a national level, and we really appreciate you and love to have you come back on the Power Hour sometime.
You got it. Joyce Riley, Nurse Joyce Riley, and you know, of course, she was with us during the Gulf War, talking about all those horrible situations as well. Speaking of horrible situations, a powerful storm system tearing through the southeast, killing at least five people, flipping over mobile homes and tractor-trailer trucks, the storm unleashing tornadoes and wind gusts as well. In a moment, Scott Stevens joins us. We're going to talk about weather control. We'll also talk with him about the currency and Bitcoin craze next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Scott Stevens with us for the next couple hours. Fascinated with weather since he was just a little guy keeping weather diaries for his scouting merit badge. A year later, he was reporting conditions in his small town in Idaho to area television stations and went on to, of course, get into the weather business. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Scott, always a pleasure.
I'm glad to be here, George. Glad to be here.
Just reported on that horrible situation in the southeast where tornadoes, wind gusts, five people dead already. What a year. It's too early for this, Scott.
I don't know, George. You know, it is the season. This is when the storm chasers get, you know, their hearts pumping and their gears out there, and they chase down these storms. It's March. No, it's April. It's April already.
Moving along very fast. Well, is this normal weather or is this manipulated weather, Scott?
Manipulated weather is now the normal weather.
Hmm.
I'm gonna settle in on that, where there's the hand of this technology that has its play in just about every event globally. You know, even here in southern Colorado today, where we should have had snows early on in the day, you know, there's been a suppression, so we've missed out on probably a third to a half of what this event could have put down. And certainly what I would have forecast, you know, 20 years ago, you know, being on the air and, you know, watching these things come in, you know, I'm far, far more conservative in forecasting precipitation when a region has been in drought. So in that regard, you know, the trend, dryness in the West, you know, is your friend.
When I go to events, Scott, one of the big questions that seems to always come up from people,
mm-hmm.
weather modification. Do you believe it, George? What are chemtrails? What are they trying to do to us? People are fascinated with this, Scott.
It's a massive, massive topic. And, you know, one that fascinated me all the way back in 1998. But I saw some of Clifford Carnicom's early work, you know, some of, you know, a picture of with, you know, the what was it, a DC-9 derivative type of plane with this massive full wingspan contrail. I'm like, that is a little odd, but honestly, I just couldn't wrap my head around the concept of why would they want to do this. And so I held the whole topic at arm's length for a couple of years. And then I got into Free Energy and Tom Bearden, and more little data bits came together. And, you know, by 2004, I was a firm believer that what I was doing as a weatherman on the air was almost futile. Almost futile. We had the technology, we had the models, we had the expertise and understanding of the weather and climate processes, and yet so many forecasts went horribly wrong. And why? Why? And it ended up being this manipulation of the weather. That is, storm by storm, you know, square mile by square mile, they know what's going on. And you've had so many shows with military guys and talking about technologies that aren't from this era. They are so far advanced of their understanding of not just this dimension, but other dimensions and other technologies and the computing power that puts, you know, Intel and Apple and these computers literally to shame. So they can have full situational awareness of what's happening on this planet, whether it's weather, whether it's in the oceans, you know, or just the massive amounts of information that is being swept up by, you know, the intelligence agencies.
So
I got there. Weather's absolutely controlled.
So let's assume that they are controlling the weather. What are they doing it for? Are they doing it to give us better weather? Are they doing it to create droughts? What are they trying to do?
I think ultimately it comes down to, you know, to money. You know, if you can make money in orange juice futures or in moving natural gas because you know weeks ahead of time there's an Arctic blast coming, or simply as a form, as Bill Clinton's defense secretary called it, eco-terrorism, something as base, and I don't like the word evil, but something as disruptive as that. And if you've got a technology that menaces a civilization, And I'm talking about humanity as a whole, menacing this civilization by oscillating us. So we're going through, like California, years of drought, crippling drought. When we talk about agriculture and sustainability, you know, and the health of the creeks, the rivers, the streams, the poor forests, and how many hundreds of millions of trees have died across the West in the last 30 to 40 years. Literally hundreds of millions of trees are dead. Colorado forests decimated by this engineering. And so then you take California too dry, and then all of a sudden this winter, you've got these dams, Orville Dam, for example, you know, being breached because there's so much water coming.
Oh my God, yeah.
And so here we are already in the first week of April, which is typically the peak snowpack. You know, April 1 is the benchmark. That for years, you know, the water managers go to the mountains. That April 1 mark is the high snow mark. And from that budget, water budgets are determined all across the West, whether it's for hydroelectric power, which keeps our air conditioners going, which keeps the hay, the alfalfa growing in the fields, and the corn, and the potatoes, and the beets, and the orchards. All of those things depend on that high snow mark on April 1. And this year, we reached that mark in February, and the snows came, and they're still coming. And even now, as I look out 2 weeks, California's not done with the rain.
Is that good, though? I mean, they were screaming they had a drought.
Yeah, and there are two ways to look at this, George. Number one, the snow comes out of the mountains gently, and that April remains cool-ish, or at least with normal to slightly below normal temperatures, so the water doesn't come down too fast. The deep water aquifers take sometimes months, but usually years and occasionally decades to recharge. So it wouldn't matter how much water was up there this year, only so much is going to get in, going to be able to recharge those deep water aquifers. The more superficial ones will be in glorious shape as we move through the next year. So it really depends on the spring melt, but I see the cool weather persisting for at least the next 14 days. And so the slower the snow comes out of these mountains, the better off the West will be.
I think you're right. Scott, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment, talk a little bit more about weather modification and the black ops. And you did bring up something very fascinating. Control the weather and then bet on the futures. That's an interesting take. Who wins? Follow the money. And then we're going to talk about money, currency, and bitcoins with Scott Stevens in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Now here's some exciting news for those of you in the northwestern part of the United States. We are going to have a live stage show Saturday, July 29th in Everett, Washington. That's right. It's going to be at the historic Everett Theater. I'm going to give you some information, some heavy hitter guests, Robert Felix talking about the Ice Age, Mystic Healer Sonia Grace, space expert and theorist Mike Barra joins us, and John Hogue, the expert on mysticism and prophecy, will be our guest, plus some live music. You're going to have a great time. All the information at coasttocoastam.com. Just go right there, get the link to the show, and off you go. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with Scott Stevens. Scott, you've hit it right on the head again. Follow the money. It's something that I really didn't think about. But when you talk about controlling the futures market with produce and all kinds of things, that's a lot of money.
Well, it sure can be. And it is every single commodity. Every single one has some impact that weather plays upon. And that's it becomes humbling when you realize the scale and scope of this. And, you know, weather was always something that, you know, whether you want to go back to Indian chiefs and rainmakers, da-da-da-da-da, by the end of World War II, you know, we're approaching D-Day and Normandy Beach. Weather was a priority. And after World War II, it was a must-own. And so from understanding Tesla's research in the 1920s and 30s to Wilhelm Reich in the 50s, they had enough pieces of this puzzle to put together the technology. And all they needed was the markers in the sky, the chemtrails disguised as contrails, you know, plausible deniability, to then, you know, set up this real-time grid to understand and literally control the weather. And so, you know, someday, you know, it went live, probably regionally, and then it became very, very inclusive of the entire planet. So, you know, and I was kind of almost done with the California discussion, and the goal in this eco-terrorism is simply that there's such a small time period where we have peaceful productivity. Californians have been gone from, you know, stressful drought to, you know, a flooding episode, and I don't know how many times in the last 20 years we've seen the Mississippi out of her banks, and the Missouri and the Red River, either the north or the south. And, you know, you reduce the productivity of your breadbasket, and then you can keep your products, your produce, much more highly priced than they would be otherwise. And that comes back to an inflationary monetary policy that we've endured since the central banks came on the scene.
What's going on with Lake Mead these days? At one point, it was declining last year to its lowest level in history. Is that picking back up again?
I would expect that it would. And the next 6 to 12 weeks will be huge. We'll see those reservoir levels come on up. The snowpack from northern New Mexico, northern Arizona, you know, all the way to southern Canada is robust this winter. So we've gone through the water, you know, rationing, and we know how to be at least somewhat more careful with our water supplies. So I would expect to see a fairly substantial rise in that lake level. And then who knows what the summer monsoon will be like. It's been rather generous the last couple of years, and that has been the saving grace with these winters so dry, is that the summer monsoons, at least through the Four Corners area, has been pretty juicy.
Well, and it gets most of its water from the snow melt in Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah, right?
Yeah, especially western Colorado and southern Utah. Those are critical, and those basins are largely greater than 150% of normal this year. So the West looks good, better than it has been in 6 years.
Wow. Now, when does that start to melt, Scott?
When does the what develop?
When does the snow start melting up?
It's begun.
Oh, it has.
It's begun. Yeah, we're there. And we'll see these streams running probably at bank full or slightly above. There's always a swelling, and we reach flood, you know, during the month of May. You know, the sun is high, the sun is warm, the high pressure begins to reestablish itself across the mountain west, and that allows the snow to come down rather quickly. So it's getting that juicy low elevation melted gently that we can, you know, kind of avoid some of the crisis of every single one of those basins in California is at or above 180%. There's a lot of water up there.
Scott Stevens here with us, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Scott, you also are interested in our currency and Bitcoin situation. Tell me why.
You know, I have always been interested in economics. You know, going back to the time I was, you know, 12 and 13 years old and subscribing to U.S. News and World Report and watching the evening news, I truly thought it was just an addiction to news in general. But, you know, I'm 15 years old and knowing how old I was, calculating compound interest, how much money I would need to retire, you know, da-da-da-da-da. You know, it was my mind with numbers. And, you know, as I have seen, I just turned 50. So I've seen a couple of business cycles come and go. And I've been, you know, interested in the alternative media and the conspiracy and the history of the Federal Reserve and how we bank. And cryptocurrencies came on the scene, you know, globally in 2009 and 2010, but I didn't become aware of them until about 2012. And I read an article that was posted on Zero Hedge. It's an economics blog. And I printed it off because it made sense. And I became interested, you know, how do we even say this? Before I went to college, it was a debate. Do business and economics or meteorology? I truly went through that, which one is it? And the love for meteorology just overwhelmed it, and I went down that road, not knowing that I was going to end up in the geoengineering and this whole other rabbit hole. But it was economics and money, and the inflation of money. When I was 13, my parents built their first house. They took out an FHA loan for $28,000.
Amazing.
$28,000. That was the cost of the house, and the house payment was $208.
Ours was $18,000 in 1957.
Yeah. So, you can't even, the average price of a car today is, you know, crossing that $30,000 mark.
Easy.
Easy. And so when we went through this last economic crisis, I had hedged myself with silver and gold. As a lot of us did. You know, it was an issue that you could see coming from 10 miles away, maybe even 100, depending on if you had your glasses on or not. You know, I could see it coming. And so I had the company I was working for, they added a gold and silver miners option to our 401k fund so we could, I could hedge that. You know, but that, the metals went nowhere in 2007 and 8 and 9, and they should have blown through the roof. And I truly got very disappointed and realized the extent that these metals, these alternative quote-unquote currencies or stores of value, were suppressed by paper copies of gold and silver. Now, even today, you know, as soon as gold is crossing $1,250, boom, somebody in 30 seconds sells $2 billion worth of paper gold and the price collapses. And, you know, you're like, come on now, guys, come on. So Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies became high on the radar when you're looking for an asset, when you're looking for a currency, when you're looking for something that hasn't been contaminated by the banks, by governments, by the establishment. And you look at the charts and they're glorious fractals, fractals that you would, you know, see in an economics book from the 1930s or 40s. I mean, truly investor, speculator, you know, emotion-based investing. And, you know, I was like, okay, so how do I get these Bitcoins? And I was going to go buy a miner and then mine the Bitcoin. And mining the coins means donating your computing power to securing the networks, to constantly processing and trying to solve an algorithm to encrypt the transactions that would have happened in the last 10 minutes. And if your hardware, your address, you know, hits the jackpot and solves the problem, then you're rewarded with these coins. And at the time, Bitcoin was $30, $35, $40. Today, it's 1,150.
Gosh, is it going to get even higher, you think?
I anticipate that we have 3, 4, potentially 5 orders of magnitude of growth. When all of the market cap of all of these coins, these cryptocurrencies today, is less than $30 billion. So that's a fraction of what Apple, Dell, IBM, these larger companies, you know, is, and it's growing.
What happens if the internet crashes?
Well,
that was a diabolical laugh, by the way.
Well, it is in a way, because every single person I have talked to about this brings up that question.
It's a real possibility.
Yeah, and you know, when I came across it in 2012, you know, there was the December 21, 2012 issue coming up. Well, that turned out to be absolutely nothing.
Amazon had an issue with its website a couple weeks ago and pulled down half the net.
Yep, Amazon Web Services. Our storefront for Blue Water Alchemy was degraded because of that outage. You know, and so there is this tenuousness to the internet, that a couple of key places, you know, whatever the reason is, lines are cut, surges on the power line, who knows? Routers go down, there's a bug, there's a hack, then you have degraded services. And when that happens, then there isn't likely to be a whole lot of online commerce going on anyway. And so that's why you've got your seed, that's why you've got your food, that's why you've got your bug out bag. But the internet, at least up until now, has never gone down for good. And because the Bitcoin network and many of these other coins that are now springing up because they complement what Bitcoin brings to the table, have nodes on every single continent, in every single state, in a lot of cities around this country, the hashing power, the computing power backing the Bitcoin network is more than 1,000 times more powerful than the greatest supercomputer on this planet.
Do you feel secure with Bitcoins now?
I do. And why I have it is simply for price appreciation.
So you're going to get out eventually?
I don't know that. I have a feeling that this system, this process, this network, this trustless mechanism for securing and transmitting value across the globe in seconds, and for a fraction of what it was cost to do with Western Union or another wire service or these remittances companies, is going to be embraced by governments. Simply because the banks that the governments have supported will not be there. And they're going to need some kind of safety net that this network will ultimately provide. And so I think we'll see a time in the not-too-distant future, because the growth of Bitcoin is exponential, that the central banks will have to own it as well. And when they do that, they will install computers also supporting, reinforcing, sustaining, and building the networks. And so I think it's going to be not an all-or-nothing game for them, but an also game for them. Because right now, most of the American economy has been propped up by consumerism funded by bubbles, housing bubbles, the dot-com bubble, the student loan bubble. It's all been bubbles. So the Fed, the government, is looking for another bubble to blow. Where's it going to go? What are they going to do? You know, they can only bail out the big banks so many times before there's a revolt. And now we have another option to transmit wealth to grandma, to the kids, to literally take it out of the banks and watch it grow.
Who's using Bitcoins across the planet? What countries are allowing it, for example?
It became legal tender in Japan on the 1st of this month. You can go to, you know, I personally use Dish Network. I can pay my Dish Network bill and pay with Bitcoin. Go to Overstock.com or Dell Computers takes Bitcoin. And so often you'll get a discount for using Bitcoin to pay your bill. Why? Because the longer that company holds that currency, the more value it holds. So the beginning of this year, Bitcoin was just crossing $1,000. This evening, we're crossing 1,150. So that is a 15% appreciation in one quarter or 3 months.
Which is huge.
It is huge. How many 401ks or pension funds have grown that much in the last three months?
Can it collapse, though?
You know, it has tried a couple of times. I don't know how many times Bitcoin has been declared dead. And yet here it is, stronger, more robust. And in a way, George, this last 8 years that it has gone from the cradle to, you know, being a player on the financial landscape has been like the Wild West. When the railroad tracks were first, you know, strung out across, you know, Kansas and Colorado and into Utah and Nevada and finally into California. And there were heists. There were train robbers. You know, there was a lot of money to be made in that rapid transit, you know, that rapid commerce across the West. But there were absolutely robber barons along the way. And, you know, Bitcoin has gone through that. But a lot of that difficulty and a lot of those kinks are now out of the system. We've learned. The system has learned, and there's been responses and corrections and additions. And the beautiful thing about these currencies, and I tend to like the privacy ones, and those are altcoins, is that their number is limited. The Fed can create $1 trillion tomorrow if we need to build a fence or fund a war or bail out a bank. That money is literally just debited into existence.
And they'll do it.
And it makes the money you hold in your checking account and your back wallet worth less. And so the number of Bitcoin right now is about 16.2 million. And that's only one for every 20 Americans.
And what retail outlets or who's accepting these as trade?
As trade.
I mean, you hold on to it for appreciation, but there are some people who use it as currency, right?
Many do. And what I use my Bitcoin for, because I want to leverage the growth, is I buy altcoins, alternative coins with different purposes. There's one, XRP is a sticker symbol, or Ripple, and it is being used by a consortium of banks, largely in the Far East, as a mechanism or a token to exchange, you know, contracts on. And so you can send literally a lot of money nearly instantaneously between banks. And the banks are on the verge, I think it was a Barclays Bank IT guide last year said, we're on the verge of losing 85% of our workforce. They become redundant when this digital asset class really moves onto the scene. So he was thinking Barclays would have 85% fewer employees by the year 2020.
They just let them go.
There's no need for them. No need.
Well, you see that already, too. That's happening now in banks.
Well, and the other thing is the ethics of the banking system is questionable. You know, if they can, I'm going in for a car loan. You know, it's a $40,000 truck. You give them $4,000 of your hard-earned money for 10% down, and where does the other $36,000 come from?
Thin air. It came from your neighbor's checking account.
Well, in fractional reserve banking, it would, but that's not even how they operate today.
I'm just afraid, Scott, that if something goes wrong, you've lost it, because at least the perception is you've got the backing of the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government on your money to a certain amount of money you have in the bank.
It's true.
And with Bitcoins, I'm petrified that one day you wake up and somebody has stolen it or something.
Well, and there are many solutions for that. There's cold storage wallets where you take your address and your personal keys and you withdraw it off the blockchain and you keep it in. It's like a USB key. It's on a cold storage wallet that is not connected to the internet.
But in the digital world, that's where it is, right?
Yeah. I mean, all of those nodes that are running the blockchain still know that your address has that credit attached to it.
Stay with us, Scott. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about weather modification. We're going to talk about Bitcoins. We're going to open up the phone lines next on Coast to Coast AM.